start today by continuing to talk about linkage and crossing over. And then from there, I want to talk about change gears a little and stop talking about how things work and start talking about how they got that way. So to begin, we talked last time about two possibilities, linkage and independent assortment. Now, the basic idea that we said is suppose you have a diploid, and it could be, it's a double heterozygote, and it could be either of these, depending on how the A's and the B's are arranged on the original parental chromosomes. But starting with a double heterozygote, suppose this cell goes through meiosis, and you get haploid products, either gametes or spores. Now, what kinds of gametes can you get out of either of these crosses? You can actually get the same four gametes. Either way, you can get big AB, big A, big AB, little AB, little A, little B, big A, little B, and little A, big B. But which are the parental or starting combinations and which are recombinant or resorted is different. Because the way from the top one, let's see, the first two would be what? Parental or recombinant? They would be parental, while the second two would be recombinant. But now, what would be parental in the other case? So the other two, somebody said. So we'll write it again. So in fact, it would be these two, big A, little a, big B, would this time be the parentals, and the other two would be recombinant. So you can classify then your gametes or products of meiosis as either parental or recombinant. Now, what does independent assortment mean? It means that the A's assort independently of the B's. Any A can go with any B, which means what are going to be the four proportions? Or put it another way, what's going to be the relative amounts of parentals and recombinants? Well, if it's going to be 1:1:1:1, which is what independent assortment is, it means whatever two are recombinant is going to be just as common as whatever two are parental. So, in fact, independent assortment means 1:1 of parental to recombinant. But what's linkage? Linkage means that whatever combination you started with tends to stick together. And so the number of parentals, the parental to recombinants, is greater than one. There are more parentals than there are recombinants. Now, it doesn't seem intuitively obvious, but as we'll see, you cannot get more recombinants than parentals. You either get even Steven, more parentals, I don't know if I said that right. Either you get even Steven or more parentals, you never get more recombinants. Now, we understand how you can get more parentals. You get more parentals because whatever you started with tends to stick together. So let's say if it was this one. In order to get a recombinant, you had to have a crossing over. There are less of those, so you get mostly parentals. How could you get independent assortment? How come the A's would go independent of the B's? We actually discussed the obvious case last time, which is that the A's are on one pair of homologs and the B's are on another. But it turns out there is another way you can get independent assortment. Remember, independent assortment is defined practically as equal number of recombinants and parentals. The other way that can happen is if the A's and the B's are on a single pair of homologs, but they're very far apart. Because if they are very far apart, then many crossovers will occur between them. And so many crossovers occur that it's random whether big A ends up with big B or little b, or whether little a ends up with big B or little b. So either of these two, these two, can give you independent assortment. Now, what this implies is there is a relationship between the number of cuts and rejoins in between the frequency of crossing over and the distance between A and B. We've referred to that or alluded to it many times, but we've never discussed it exactly. So let's consider two cases. Here we both have A and B on the same homolog, pair of homologs, but in one case A and B is closer to each other, and in one A and B is far apart. We think that crossing over itself is fairly common, that crossing over occurs probably always during meiosis. But let's say it happens on the average once per pair per meiosis. So crossing over or cutting and rejoining is going to occur here somewhere. And it's going to occur here somewhere. But the question is, what is the chance it will occur between A and B? So if we cut here randomly, sometimes it will come in between A and B, sometimes it will come outside. Well, so what? If I cut and rejoin outside, does that flip my A's and B's? And the answer is no, so I won't notice. So the important question here, to flip my A's and B's and get a recombinant, I have to have a cut in between A and B. Now, if I just chop at random, if I chop in the bottom case, I'll almost always hit in between A and B. Because the distance is large, the target is large, and the chance that I'll hit in between A and B is big. But in the top case, I won't hit between A and B all the time. Sometimes I'll hit here, sometimes here, sometimes here. So the smaller the interval between A and B is, the less likely my chop will just happen to come in between. And you can see in this case, it's almost always going to be outside. So the number of times the DNA gets cut and rejoined or recombined, the number of recombination events is proportional to distance. So if we can measure the number of recombinant events, combination events, we can in fact get the distance between A and B. So how are we going to measure the number of recombination events? We can't usually look at the results of a single meiosis. We have to look at the results of many pooled meioses. We look at many gametes or spores. And what we do is we check what proportion are parental and what proportion are recombinant. And we define what is called the recombination frequency, or the RF, which is just the percent of the products of meiosis that are recombinant, which is just the recombinance over the total. When you look at all the products of meiosis, it's the recombinance over the total times 100. Well, RF, recombination frequency, is a way of measuring how many recombination events occur. Is recombination frequency proportional to distance? And the answer is yes in the right range, but no in the wrong range. As long as A and B are pretty close together, the recombination frequency, the way we've defined it, is proportional to distance. But if A and B are too far apart, recombination frequency is not going to be proportional to distance. And the reason for that is, if you have a lot of crossing over, some of the crossovers will put you back the way you started and you won't notice. But to understand that, we have to look at this more closely. And that's what I want to do next. And in order to do that, you want to look at today's handout, size A, side A. here are the possible results of a single meiosis. So if you have a cell and has a pair of homologs that have the A's and the B's on them. Now, before you can do anything, of course, you have to double the DNA. So we've done that first. And so we can put our A's and B's on, etc. Now, what happens if there is a single crossover event? This is very much what we talked about last time, but in more detail. We said if there is no crossover event at all, you get the case on the left. No crossover. When you finish meiosis, you get one pink or wiggly chromosome in two of the gametes, and one white or straight chromosome in two of the gametes. So you get equal numbers of big AB. Per meiosis, you get two A big AB and two little AB. But what if there has been one crossover event? So let's sort of blow that up here. Now, remember, each of these lines is a double-stranded DNA molecule. And a crossover event means that we cut one and we cut another chromatid in the equivalent spot. Now, if we exchange sisters, you'd never notice the difference. So we're always talking here about a chromatid from one homolog exchanging with a chromatid from the other. And then we reconnect them so that when we straighten it out, as we explained last time, the two bottom chromatids didn't do anything. In any single event, you're only involving two chromatids. And so you end up with recombinant chromatids, chromosomes, like this. Now, in terms of A's and B's, what have we done? We've switched the A's and left the B's alone. So it would be like this. Now, how come only half of our chromatids get engaged in the act? That's because crossing over occurs after DNA replication when you have four copies of the DNA, when the cell is 4C, not 2C. And since there are two copies of everything, two of the copies don't do anything, and two of them engage in crossing over. Another thing to notice here is if you make a little a big B, you have to make a big A little b. Because this actually works by the cutting and rejoining of real physical molecules, not copying, but actually cutting and pasting. Because it works that way, every time you make one recombinant, you have to make its reciprocal. And in fact, the discovery that crossing over was reciprocal, that you always got one if you got the other, was a clue that we were actually cutting and repasting chromosomes. So what happens if there's a single crossover? So this is no crossovers. Now, what if there's one? That's what we just drew. So what's going to happen at the end is this chromatid is going to be in one gamete, or product of meiosis, this in another, this in another, this is another. So what are the four products going to be? We're going to get two that are just like the original. That's the top and the bottom, but two that are recombinant. So two parentals and two recombinants. From a single crossover event, we don't get all recombinants. We never get more than half. Now, these are the two cases we considered yesterday, last time. And we're going to consider the third case in a minute. But let's stick to these for now. Now, what's this curve on the bottom? This is a measure of recombination frequency between A and B as a function of the distance of A to B. Now, one way of looking at this is to ask, if A and B are very close together, what's happening? If A and B are very close together, which of these, we'll call these sort of type 1 results, type 2, or type 1 meiosis, all parental, type 2 meiosis, half and half. If you have A and B very close together, how is meiosis going to turn out most of the time? It's going to be type 1. Now, you look, remember, for recombination frequency, you look at the result of many, many meioses. But almost all of them are like this. And so, if A and B are very close together, you get almost all parentals. Now, what's the limit? As A and B get closer and closer and closer and closer together, you get more and more of this kind, less and less of those. And in fact, in the limit, you get all parentals. So, in fact, the recombination frequency, what's the recombinance? It's recombinance over the total. If A and B are close together, how many recombinants do you get? Zilch. So the recombination frequency is zero. It approaches zero as A and B get closer and closer together. Now you can look at this two ways. And there's actually sort of a little table in your notes. And one of the columns in it is recombination frequency, and one of them is linkage. If the recombination frequency approaches zero, what would you say about linkage? Linkage is a measure of how often the A and B you started with stay together. So what was it? It was 100%. The big A, big B alleles stuck together, little a, B. So if the recombination frequency is zero, the linkage is 100%. And this is what you get if the AB distance is very low or approaching zero. Everything is a type, all meioses are type 1. And so from many, many meioses, you're going to get mostly parentals. You're going to get all parentals. RF is going to be zero, linkage 100%. All right, so we know what this point is. Now, you notice the curve looks sort of like this. Let's consider this point. What's happening here? A and B aren't right on top of each other. They're a little bit apart. So what's going to happen? And maybe we should consider this point, too, and what's the difference? Compared to point 1... what's going to happen to meiosis? It's still going to be most of the time like this. But with point 2, we're going to get a few more like this. And what about point 3? We're still going to get mostly this kind, type 1, but a few more type 2s. So what's happening in this part of the curve is that A and B get a little further and further apart. The number of type 2s gets a little bit larger. The number of parentals gets lower. The number of recombinants gets higher. So the recombination frequency goes up. So as A and B get further apart in the linear part of the curve, you get mostly 1, but you get more and more 2s. So you get some recombinants. More recombinants as A and B get further apart. The RF goes up proportional to distance. And what happens to linkage? Just sort of in English terms. Goes up, goes down, stays the same. Linkage decreases because A and B don't stay together all the time. They get switched sometimes. But they stay together most of the time. So the linkage decreases. Now, why does the curve level off? What's happening, say, around here? You're still getting more and more cutting and rejoining events. So we have to figure now, what would happen if you had two or more crossover events between A and B? We'll just write more than one. So now, if you have multiple crossovers, how is meiosis going to come out? Now, all of these are worked out in your notes. We're not going to do all the details. But there are actually three different possibilities which are equally likely. Either you'll get all parental, or you'll get all recombinant, or you'll get half and half. Now, what do we mean by this? A multiple crossover means either a crossover event here and then, say, another one. Now, if it's the same chromatids that do it, they'll switch you back where you were before. On the other hand, these two could switch, and then the two outer could switch too. That would get all the A's and B's switches. That would be this one. Or, the first case, we did it and then we put ourselves back again. That was this one. So, all of these three are possible. And they're all equally likely. They're all worked out if you want. But what's the net result? If you have an individual meiosis, you can get all parental or all recombinant or half and half. But what if you have many, many meioses and each one has multiple crossovers? Then on the average, half of your products will be recombinant and half of them will be parental. Notice, with many, many crossovers, you don't get all recombinants. In one meiosis, yes, but in many meioses, no. So the net result of many meioses with lots of crossovers is half of the time your A's and B's come out the way they started, and half the time they get switched. So the maximum recombination frequency is 50%. Half switched, half the same. And that's why the curve is flat over here. So that says if A and B are very far apart, then you get maybe a few ones, maybe a few twos, but actually you get mostly type 3, where more than one crossover. You get half and half. The RF is 50%. Now, what does it mean if the recombination frequency is 50%? Half parental, half recombinant. Do you have linkage? How did we define independent assortment? We said the A's are independent of the B's, right? Either A is equally likely to go with either B. In fact, that's half parental and half recombinant. So this is defined as independent assortment or no linkage. Now, it might be better to say no genetic linkage. No linkage through crosses. No linkage through crosses may mean they're on separate chromosomes. But no linkage through crosses may mean they're so far apart on the same chromosome that they get scrambled. Now, one way to see why would the A and B get scrambled is because all the meioses, this is sort of type 1, type 2, and type 3, if all the meioses are type 3, then half the time the A's and B's get switched and half the time they don't. Another way to see that is to consider AB. I'm just going to stick to 2 for the moment, but there's really 2 copies of the top and 2 of the bottom. What happens if there are multiple crossovers? Well, that's sort of equivalent to doing this. So is big A more likely to come out with big B or little B? Another way of saying it is, you're going to get many crossovers. Half the time it's an odd number. Half the time it's an even number. If it's an odd number, you switch the A's and the B's. If it's an even number, you end up back where you started with. Well, they're equally likely. So half the time the A's and the B's get switched, and half they don't. So either way you look at it, if A and B are far enough apart, their inheritance is randomized. Any A with any B. So independent assortment can mean one of two things. Either the genes were on separate chromosomes, or they were far apart on the same one. So maybe we should do one more thing to be sure people have got it. If A and B are very far apart, and you measure the recombination frequency between them, you'll get some number. Let's say you get a number like this. I didn't draw my curve well enough. But suppose the recombination frequency is, say, 35%. Now, is that a good reflection of the number of recombination events? Is it a good estimate, an underestimate, or an overestimate? This says 35% of the time the A's and the B's got switched. That means there was an awful lot of crossing over. That means some of the time when there was crossing over, you crossed back where you started with. So actually, there was more crossing over than this reflects. This is an underestimate. So as long as you stick to distance, to recombination frequencies, usually about or less than 25%, that's the linear part here. And in that range, recombination frequency is proportional to distance. But larger recombination frequencies are not accurate. They are underestimates because you didn't count the doubles and the triples and the quadruples. Now, how do you use this? We explained last time that linkage is sometimes useful because the positional information can be used for prediction, isolating genes, etc. Traditionally, linkage and recombination frequencies within this range have been used to make maps. And let's do a simple example to be sure people get it. Now, we've been talking about crossing over where you started, say, with something like this, and you detected a crossover because the A's and the B's got switched. But when we were talking, and remember, these are double-stranded DNAs, not Watson and Crick. But when we were talking about bacterial genetics, though, we usually talked about having two mutations on the DNA and having a crossover in between them. Now, these cases are equivalent. The idea is you have some spot on the chromosome where you can tell the two homologs apart. Big A versus little a, mutant versus normal. And you have two marked spots, so if there's crossing over between them, you would know. So either you detect recombination because you get big AB, little AB, or you detect recombination. How would you detect it here? Well, if you cut and rejoined, you might get a good one. Anything else? But you might also get the double mutant, because remember, crossing over is reciprocal. So every time you join the left bottom to the right top, you join the left top to the right bottom. So you'd also get double mutant. Now, why do we always talk about looking for this one? We usually detect this by phenotype. Now, the phenotype of a single mutant and a double mutant is often the same, and they're not distinguishable. But the phenotype of the normal is distinguishable from the others. It grows, it hybridizes, something. But when you're measuring recombination frequencies, if you only count the number of good recombinants, is that accurate? You have to count these guys too. And often you don't count them. So how do you know how many there should have been? For every one of the double good ones, you should have had a double bad one, even if you didn't see it. So you have to remember that when you do your calculations. Okay, so suppose you start out with a heterozygous AB. We'll draw it this way. Wouldn't matter which one. And you get 14% big A, little B, little A, big B. Now, are these recombinants or parentals? We went through meiosis. What did we get? Are those recombinants or parentals? Those are recombinants. So my RF is 14%. And in that range, RF is proportional to distance. So by convention, 1% recombination frequency is called one map unit, or one centimorgan. All of this business was figured out in Morgan's lab in Skermerhorn about 100 years ago, which is why they've had these centennial lectures. And the unit of distance in his honor was named the centimorgan, but it's also called the map unit. Now, the person who actually figured out how to make maps and to use recombination frequency to get distance was an undergraduate at Columbia University named Sturtevant. So probably they should have named this the Sturt, but they didn't. They named something else the Sturt, but it didn't catch on. So this means that if I write the A or the alpha gene and the beta gene, the distance between them by convention is 14 map units or 14 centimorgans. Now I do a different cross using, say, BC, and I get this time 4% recombinance. Now, what would a recombinant be this time? Would it be big B, big C, or big B, little c? A recombinant. It would be big B, big C would be a recombinant. So that says, what does this tell me? How far apart are B and C? Not very, but what's the number? 4 map units. B, C is 4 map units from B. Where is C? Well, actually, I don't know. I have two possibilities. Either C is down here, 4 map units, or C is here, 4 map units. So how would I know? I have to do an AC cross and find out if the AC distance is 10 map units or 18. And that's what you do. Now, maps are additive when you stick to small distances. They are not additive when you stick to large distances because you have this problem of multiple crossovers and you're not really counting all the recombinants. Now, in your notes, there is a summary of many of the features of this, which we've all said at one time or another, but not in one place, so I won't go over it. It's there for reference, but there is one thing I want to mention, and that's the issue of double crossovers. Suppose you have chromosomes where you have, say, big A, big B, big D. I'm going to use D instead of C because big D and little d look more different. Now, of course, at the time the crossing over occurs, which is prophase one of meiosis, each of these are double-stranded, of course, and they're part of chromatids. They're actually, they are parts of chromosomes that have two chromatids. But for the moment, we're just going to look at two of them and a possible double crossover. How do you get, for example, big A, little b, big D? In order to do that, we had to exchange the parts of the chromosome containing the B. How many cut and rejoin events did that require? And the answer is 2. You don't sort of go in and swoop and pick up B and switch B. Instead, you take your scissors and tape, aka enzymes, and you cut the DNA between A and B, and you switch. And you cut the DNA between B and D, and you switch. And that's how you get this one. Now, I have a question. You get some ABDs, big A, little B, D, big Ds out of this. How is that going to compare with the number of big A, little B, little B? How many cut and rejoins did it take to get you big A, little B, little D? 1. How many did it take to get big A, little b, big D? 2. So which is going to be more common? This one. Now, this trick is often used to get order. Because if this is the right order, then we know which of these will be more common. But if the order were, say, ADB, then it would be a different ones that would be most common and least. And there are some examples of how you use this in the problem book. The issue here is not the exact numbers, but what is more common and what is less. Because if we know the chance of a crossover here, and we know the chance of a crossover here, the chance that they'll both happen is what? You add or multiply? The chance of this and that is multiply. So you multiply it, and if this is less than 1 and that's less than 1, then their product is smaller. Now, there's one more crossing over fact or aspect that we have to think about. And that's the fact that many of the organisms we analyze are diploid. When we talked about bacterial genetics, we were largely talking about haploids. Now, we did have partial diploids, but your organisms were basically haploid. But all the organisms that you are familiar with, that you see around with the naked eye, they're all diploid, all those multicellular organisms. So how do you figure out the recombination frequency when you're using diploids? Well, if you did a cross of this kind, double heterozygote cross double heterozygote, well, if you wanted to measure recombination frequency, of course, you'd have to know which one you had. It's not enough to write heterozygote. I have to know what's on one of the chromosomes. Say, the big A and the big B are on one, the little a, b on the other, say. Okay? Now, if you did it that way, and you got an organism, you got a zygote that had the A, capital A, capital B phenotype, is that the result of two parentals meeting, two recombinants meeting, one parental meeting a recombinant? There's really no way of telling at all. You'd have to do an awful lot of work to find out. So this is not how you do it. You set it up so one parent is doubly heterozygous and the other is double homozygous recessive. Now, any cross where one parent is homozygous recessive for all genes in question is called a test cross. Now, what's the advantage of this? Well, do I have to worry about crossing over in this parent? Notice, crossing over in this parent makes no difference whatsoever. So all I have to worry about is crossing over in this parent. And I want to deduce from the offspring, diploids, what gametes came from this parent. That's what I want to know. Because the proportion of gametes from this parent will tell me what the recombination frequency is. Well, this time, suppose I get an A blank, B blank phenotype. Well, I immediately know that I got little AB from the recessive parent, and I got big AB from this parent. So was that a recombinant gamete or a parental? That was a parental, and I can tell just from looking. So by looking at the proportions that I get by phenotype, I know what gametes this made, and how I can calculate the recombination frequency. Now, there is a handout for this, number C for today, which is online. I didn't hand it out, which just explains in more detail how to do this and gives you a concrete example. And the books explain it as well, and then you can try the problems. Now, there are many more interesting details of crossing over and recombination, both in terms of measuring it and in terms of the molecular details. And these are covered in advanced courses. And I don't want to say any more about it. I want to go on and talk about something else. But before I do that, let me ask what questions people have. Does one talk about a percent of linkage? Usually not. Usually one sticks to percent of either distance or recombination frequency. People talk about strong linkage and weak linkage, but they don't usually put numbers on it. Any other questions? Yes?
You mentioned right 14% for RM,
right? No, 14% is what you got in that example. But the rule is that 1% RF is known as one map unit. And therefore, 14% RF is 14 map units. Yeah. Did you have a question? No. Okay. Yeah.
You're saying that above 25% is an underestimate of how many crosses there were, how many combinations there were.
Yeah.
Because they're not accounting for multiples. That would be interesting.
What we're saying is 25% is an arbitrary cutoff. The point is that this gets less and less accurate with time. But the idea is that with the RF, you're only counting detectable crossovers, not actual number of crossovers. And detectable means switched combination. And as the number gets higher and higher, the number you didn't count gets higher and higher because more and more cases were like this. Now, you can make corrections for undetectable ones, and that's the kind of thing they discuss in genetics, and we're not going to talk about it. So we've been talking up until now, all semester, about how things work. How one E. coli makes two, how one eukaryotic cell makes two, how one eukaryotic multicellular organism gets together with another one and reproduces. All of that's about how things work. And I want to switch a little bit for the rest of the time and ask, how did they get to be the way they are? Now, there are some examples of this that are worth mentioning, which is we know, for example, that blood type O is more common than B. But we know the proportion of O varies in different parts of the world. We know that cystic fibrosis is more common in whites than it is in blacks, and sickle cell disease is more common in blacks than it is in whites. We know that if you look at the genetic material, there's more variation in introns than there is in exons. And there's more variation in position 3 of the codon than in positions 1 and 2. So how do you explain all that stuff? The pattern of variation that we now have in the world, how did it get to be that way? Now, the short answer to all of this is evolution by natural selection. To put it another way, looking at the data that we have, it's pretty clear that we are all descended from a common ancestor, what's often called common descent by modification. And the mechanism by which this happens is largely, but not entirely, natural selection. So, in order to understand how that works, you have to actually look at the other case. We know that over time, populations have split and become modified, so they become different from each other. But in order to understand this, we have to go back and say, what if a population stays the same? What makes it stay the same? Under what conditions? And then we'll ask, under what conditions will it not stay the same? And in order to do this, we have to stop talking about individuals and talk about populations. And that's why I've written population genetics. Because it's not individuals that adapt, but populations that adapt. So we have to start talking about populations. Now, we all know how you write the genotype of an individual. How do you write the genotype of a population? Well, the genotype of a population is also known as the genetic structure of the population, same idea. And you define the frequency of the alleles and the frequency of the genotypes. Now, the easiest way to explain this is to use an example and then to generalize. Let's suppose we have a population where everybody, we're considering gene A, two alleles, and everybody is heterozygous. Okay, so what are the alleles here? They're big A and little a. And what's the frequency of these alleles? Well, in the population as a whole, everybody has one big A and one little a. So in the population as a whole, it's one half big A and one half little a. It doesn't have to always be this way. We just pick these numbers because they're easy to manipulate as an example. Now, what about the possible genotypes? for A. Well, you can be big A, big A, big A, little A, and little A, little A. There are three possible ones. So what are the frequencies of those? Once I put those numbers in, I have the genotype or the genetic structure of the population. Well, in this case, it's pretty easy. Since everybody is heterozygous, the frequency of FA is 1, or 100%, and the other two are 0. Well, let's suppose we started with a population like this, and we let anybody marry wherever they wanted to. What would you get in the next generation? Well, you don't have a lot of choice here. Heterozygote has to marry a heterozygote, so this is pretty easy. Or even if they do it common law, it doesn't gonna make any difference. The results are all gonna be the same. That a big A, a heterozygote marries a heterozygote, what do you get? If you don't remember, you draw your little square, and you're gonna get, in fact, 1/4 big A, big A, 1/4 little A, little A, and 1/2 big A, little A. Now, in terms of defining our genotype of the population, all we've really said is the frequency of big A is 1/4, little A is 1/4, and big A, little A is 1/2, and of course that accounts for everybody. What about the frequency of the alleles? Well, just by inspection here, there's equal numbers of these two, and they kick in equal numbers of big A and little A, and there's then the heterozygotes are equal, big A, little A, so in fact that hasn't changed at all. The frequency of the alleles is the same, I could write it up here, but the frequency of the genotypes is different. All right, that was easy. What about the next generation? Well, if you had to, you could do it. You could figure out, okay, we know what happens if two of these marry each other, and we know what proportion, 1/4 and 1/4, we could figure that out. You could figure out all the crosses, what's going to happen, what proportions you get from each one, and add it all up. You can do that. But in order to do that, you have to make certain assumptions. And if those assumptions are true, there's a much easier way to do it. But what are the assumptions that you're making? First of all, you're making the assumption that a chance a big A will meet a big A is just has to do with their proportion in the population. Nobody says, I don't like big A, big A. I'm only taking little A, little A. This is called non-random. This is called random mating. Then you have to assume that from everybody is equally likely to pass on their genes, or more correctly, their alleles. That means that not only is it random who you do it with, but everybody is going to do it, and everybody is equally successful. So every combination produces an equal number of offspring on the average. That's called no selection. Now notice these are different. We would call random mating in English no selection of a mate. But in genetics terms, selection refers to ability to pass on your alleles. Not who you do it with, but whether you're going to do it and how successfully. Now, there is one other thing we have to assume. If we're going to make a prediction that big A cross big A, how often it happens and what you get, we have to assume we have a lot of each kind of cross so that our statistics will be good. If we have a very small population, then we're not going to get exactly what we want. If you have two heterozygotes, and they start the next generation, are they going to pass on exactly equal amounts of big A and little A each? Chances aren't too good. Just by luck, one of them will pass on a few too many big A's or little A's. It might cancel out, might go in one direction. So you have to assume there's a large population, because if there are lots of heterozygotes, then on the average, they pass on half big A, half little A. Well, if all that's true, you can do it a different way. You can consider that there is what is called a gene pool, or what I consider the pot method of predicting the next generation. So I brought along a pot, so to speak. You know, it's like the lottery, okay? So we have here equal proportions of big A and little a. That's equivalent to having a big pot with little slips. Half of them have big A on them, half of them have little a. In this case, half are pink and half are green. So what's the chance, let's say pink, to make it easy, is little a. Okay? So this is pink and this is green. What is the chance of getting a homozygous little a? It's the chance, if I pick honestly, of getting two pinks. If I close my eyes and I shake it up real well and I pick twice, what's the chance I'll get two pinks? Well, there are two in here, right? So what's the chance I'll pick pink? It's just a half. And next time, it's just a half. So in fact, one quarter of the time, I'll get two pinks. What about two greens? Same thing. Now, what about heterozygotes? Well, obviously, if it's this is a quarter, they're a half. But what's the rationale? How could I get a heterozygote? Either I could pick pink and then green, or green and then pink. So what's the chance of that? We said the fact of green-green was a quarter, pink-pink was a quarter, but green-pink and pink-green are also a quarter. So these two together are a half. So the chance that there are two ways to get a heterozygote, this is really the same argument as with crosses, there's two ways to get a heterozygote, so half the time I'm going to get one pink and one green, half the time. Now what I just said is, what's the next generation going to be like? Is it going to be different? The next generation is going to be exactly the same. Once I allowed free mixing, or the equivalent of the pot, stays the same. Every generation puts back into the pot half pink and half green. We shake the pot, that's what this means. And everybody puts in equal numbers, that's what no selection is, and you got a large sample, so your pick is legit. It's like the lottery, except, you know, it's not fixed. So the idea then is that in one generation, you reach this state, and if our conditions are met, it just stays the same from generation to generation. And this is called, this state is called genetic equilibrium. Now, genetic equilibrium means that if you know what the frequency of A is, and you know what the frequency of big A is, then the frequency of little a is just going to be the frequency of homozygous little a is just the frequency of little a squared. The frequency of homozygous big A is just the frequency of big A squared. And the frequency of heterozygotes is 2 times these 2. The generalization of this is called the Hardy-Weinberg law. This, by the way, is on your handout on the other side. The idea is you call the frequency of one allele, traditionally you call P. The frequency of the other allele you call Q. I'm random about which is which. And if that's true, well, if these are the only two alleles, we know something. The frequency of these two has to add up to 1. Everybody is one. Every allele is one or the other. And P plus Q equals 1. This is always true. Equilibrium, no equilibrium. But if you're in genetic equilibrium, then the frequency of big A, is going to be what? It's the chance of picking big A twice, which is just P squared. The chance of picking a heterozygote, let's do little a first. Little a is going to be just going to be Q squared. And heterozygote is going to be 2PQ. But if everybody, this is the frequency of the 3 possible genotypes, then we know that in fact all of these have to add up to 1. Or P squared plus 2PQ plus Q squared equals 1. And this is a consequence of the fact that if there's no selection, large population, etc., this person is equally likely to pass on big A or little a. It's obvious for the other two. But this follows from the fact, which Mendel discovered, that even though this person may look like there's no little a there, this person has an equal chance of passing on either one. Well, there are usually two responses to this. One of them is, oh my God, math. The other one is, are you kidding me? They're famous for proving that if you square the both sides, you get this. Well, the real truth is, this is not very complicated to use, but it's not trivial either. This has some uses and implications which are very valuable. And I'm going to explain two of them, and then you can try the problems. One example is, if you know a population is in equilibrium, meaning things haven't changed over many generations, then you can actually use this relationship to figure things out which are not easily done otherwise. For example, if you know for some recessive condition how many people have it, you can figure out how many carriers there are. Because the people with the disease are little a, and their proportion is q squared. So I can get q from the square root. But once I have q, I can get p because p plus q equals 1. So if I have p and I have q, how many carriers are there? 2pq. Now, a classic example of this involves cystic fibrosis, and all the numbers are written on your handout, so I'm just going to jump over them, that we know one person in 2,000, or that's a frequency of 5 times 10 to the minus 4, is a live birth with this condition. So this person is, this is the frequency of little a, or p, or q squared. So the square root of this is q. And from that, you can get the frequency of the actual allele. And now you can figure out what is the frequency of heterozygotes or carriers, and it turns out to be 1 in 25. 1 in 25, and this is largely for the Caucasian population, 1 in 25 is a carrier of the recessive allele that causes cystic fibrosis. So that means there are a couple people in this room who are carriers. And if you consider how many people are in the United States, which is a couple hundred million, there are an awful lot of people who are carriers. And if you could do carrier testing, then you would know which couples were at risk of having this condition, a child with this condition. And if you could do carrier testing, you would be rich and famous. Which is why people have tried to develop a test for this, which isn't so easy to do, because it turns out that all the defective alleles aren't the same. What we call little a means your allele is sufficiently messed up so you can't make the protein. But there's more than one way to do that. And there's a problem about that in the book. But the point is that you can calculate the frequency of heterozygotes from the frequency of people with the disease. Now, this brings up a very important question. People with this disease generally do not reproduce. So how can we be in genetic equilibrium? Well, remember it's called equilibrium. What's an equilibrium? It means you have a balance. Doesn't mean things are static. It means all the factors balance out. So what it really means is that all, if there are any deviations, they balance out. And there's one more factor, actually, we've been assuming here. We've been assuming that nobody is fiddling with that pot. Nobody is painting pink ones green or slipping pink ones in when I'm not looking. That's called mutation or migration. And we're assuming there isn't any of that either. Now, it's possible there's a large pool, and it's possible that there's random mating, but is there no selection for people with cystic fibrosis? Are people with cystic fibrosis just as likely to pass on their alleles as heterozygotes and homozygotes? No way. On the other hand, there's a low rate of mutation. And the low rate of mutation from normal allele to cystic fibrosis is probably balanced by selection against homozygotes, and we've reached the steady state. So we are in genetic equilibrium, not necessarily because they're all true, but because any small deviations balance each other out. Now, what is another way you can use the Hardy-Weinberg? And that's to find out, are you in genetic equilibrium? Now, genetic equilibrium means the frequency of genotypes and alleles hasn't been changing generation over generation. So you would think you would either have to wait around a bunch of generations, or you would sort of have to take the population and divide them up. You'd assign them to generation X, generation Y, etc., and you'd measure separately what the proportions were. You don't have to do any of that. What Hardy-Weinberg says is, you just take the whole population and you measure these proportions and you say, can I assign a value of P and Q that add up to 1 and fit these proportions? And if I can, I'm in genetic equilibrium. Now, an example of that is below, where it says case 1, which is the real situation in the United States, where in fact 30% are homozygous M, 50% are MN, and 20% are NN. M and N are are alleles of the same gene. They specify slightly different forms of the same protein on the surface of your blood cells. So by using antibodies as reagent, it's very easy to tell whether somebody is MM, MN, or NN. This is very much like A and B without the O. So we know, in fact, who is each genotype, and we can calculate from that what ought to be the proportion of the alleles. And in fact, if you do that, it works out that homozygous M is 30% or 0.3. So if we're in equilibrium, the frequency of M should be the square root of 0.3, or it should be about 0.55. And from the frequency of NN, we can figure that the frequency of N should be the square root of 0.2, which is about 0.45. Now, does that look okay? It does, because these add up to 1. So if I say this is P and this is Q, then my genotypes are in the right proportions. Now, the first time you see this, it seems incredible that it does. It has to work. There are just too many variables here. Of course it works. Don't be ridiculous. But it doesn't always work. So I put in a second example to prove that it doesn't always work. Suppose we have what we call case 2. Suppose you go to, I don't know, some island somewhere, and you check out M and N proportions, and you find that instead of being 30, 50, 20%, it's 25, 60, and 15. Well, are we in genetic equilibrium? Well, one way to check is, if I take the square root of this, that should give me the frequency of M. And if I take the square root of this, it should give me the frequency of N. But if you do that, it doesn't add up to 1. So you can't assign a value of P and Q such that this is P squared, this is 2PQ, and this is Q squared. It is impossible. So this population is not in genetic equilibrium. But can I get the frequency of M and N, the two alleles? Think about the pot. Yes, I could. I could say, out of 100 people, I have 25 of these, 60 of these, 15 of these. Each of those people has 2 slips of paper. These guys write MM on M on both slips. These people write M on one slip and N on the other. And these people write N on both slips. And we just put them all in the pot and mix it up. What will the proportions be in the pot? Now I'll have 200 total slips, and I can see what's going to be on them. It's written out. I'm not going to do the whole calculation, but the point is that's the pot or the seat of the pants or the bean counter method. And if you just do that, you will discover, in fact, that the frequency of M is 0.55, and the frequency of N is 0.45. Now, of course, it adds up to 1. It has to. The frequency of the alleles in the two is the same, but the frequency of the genotypes is different. They have different genetic structures or different genotypes to the population. So we don't have equilibrium here, and you would have to ask, why not? Which of these things is responsible? But the point is, you don't have to have genetic equilibrium. And if you don't, you can still calculate what's in the pot, but you can't use it by do it by using the Hardy-Weinberg law. You have to just calculate it out. Now, everything we've discussed so far is about equilibrium, with this exception, but this isn't one. If you have all of those conditions met, your population will actually stay the same from generation to generation. What evolution means is your population makeup changes from generation to generation. And what we want to ask is, if the population changes, what is responsible? Before I do that, are there questions about this? Yeah.
So how is cystic fibrosis? How did we know that that was in equilibrium?
How do we know that cystic fibrosis is in equilibrium? We know that from data from many years. I'm just saying, suppose we knew that, then we could make the calculation.
Oh, and the data is...
But in fact, the data does fit the Hardy-Weinberg. The thing is more complicated with cystic fibrosis. In the case of M and N, can you tell the proportion of heterozygotes directly?
Yeah.
You can, because this is a surface protein that can be measured. So I can actually measure the proportions of all three. In the case of cystic fibrosis, by a simple test, can I tell a carrier from a normal? I can't. I could measure enzyme protein levels. There are sophisticated ways, but it's not easy. So to prove that we're in equilibrium, you would actually use the Hardy-Weinberg law, which people have, but we didn't do that. Yeah?
If
If you have more than two possible alleles, then you just have to say P, Q, and R, and you have to square P plus Q plus R equals 1, and then you get the equivalent Hardy-Weinberg law. Yeah? You can extend it to any number of alleles. Now, if you get a change in the population, what is responsible? I need my big chalk, and I don't see where I put it. So that's all right, I got more. Oh, I see. Okay, so we get a change in the population. What's the reason? So there are four obvious candidates. One is non-random mating. One is selection. One is small population. And the final one is mutation or migration. Now, in your notes, there are many details about all of these, but I want to say what the bottom line is for three of them and then concentrate on this one. Non-random mating means that who you do it with is not random. Maybe tall prefers tall, maybe short prefers short, maybe opposites attract, whatever. But it's different from selection. Selection, non-random mating means who you do it with isn't random. Selection means even though everybody doesn't do it, some people don't get to have children, or different matings have different numbers of children. So you can have non-random mating and still have no selection in the genetic sense, meaning who you marry isn't random, but you all do it, and you all have equal numbers of children. That would be non-random mating, but no selection. Now, non-random mating, in the absence of selection, does that change what's in the pot, the proportion of big A and little a? It doesn't, but it changes the proportions in which they are found. It changes the genotypes. If MMs only marry MMs and NNs only marry NNs, then in fact we will have more homozygotes and less heterozygotes. Now this could be explained by the other kind of non-random mating, that maybe Ms prefer Ns. Now we know that's not really true. You have no idea when you do it who you're doing it with in the MN department. But suppose somehow M's prefers N's, then there would be more heterozygotes than anything else. So that's one possible explanation. But the interesting thing is that non-random mating doesn't change the makeup in the pot at all. So it doesn't change the actual critical proportion of alleles in the population from generation to generation. So we're not so interested in this one. Now, what about mutation or migration? We understand about migration. People move from one place to another, and that changes allele frequencies. Now, the mutation is more interesting. Mutation is the source of all variation. But the question is, why does one mutation spread and another one doesn't? That usually is not because this one occurred and that one didn't. Usually both mutations happened, but one of them was favored for some reason and the other one wasn't. So what we're saying is change is not usually driven by mutation. You have to have mutation to get change, but mutation generally is not driving it. So we'll leave this one off. Now, what do small populations have to do with it? We already explained that if you have a small population, then you don't expect to have things passed on in the exact predicted proportions. So you might just by chance have some alleles get more common and some be less. And we know this has actually happened in human evolution because at times the population has been very small. So we're going to ignore this one for now. It's important, but that we think is not the cause of most of the variation that we see now. Some of the, you can look at it, what causes change over time while you watch it. Or you could say, okay, let's look around the world right now. There's an awful lot of variation from organism to organism and population to population. What caused that variation? And we're saying that most of the variation we see now and the way it is arranged, most of that is the result of selection. Some of it is due to chance. If an asteroid hits the Earth, it doesn't eliminate the unfit or favor the fit. It just lands. Brick falls off a building, it just lands. And it's just luck who gets the X. So chance has something to do with this. But we think that selection is the main driving factor. Now, why do we think that? Variation is distributed all over the world. If it were just random, then it would be random where the variation is. But we've already said there's more variation in introns and exons. There's more variation in position 3 of the codon than in position 1 and 2. That's explained by selection. Mutation happens everywhere, but if you have a mutation in an intron or position 3, it's not selected against. It just gets passed on. But if you have a mutation in an exon and it changes function, then it's going to be selected against. And if it improves function, it's going to be selected for. A classic example is bears. There are bears with thick fur and bears with thin fur, bears with white and bears with brown. But they're not scattered all over the world. The thick-furred white bears just happen to be in the Arctic. And the thin-furred brown bears just happen to be in Yellowstone. Now that makes sense because of selection. If there's this variation in both populations, but up north, if you're white, the seals can't see you coming and you eat well. If your fur is thick, you do well in the winter, you have a lot of offspring, you pass on the thick fur allele, you pass on the white fur allele. If you have a dark fur allele, the seals see you coming, you don't eat very well, and you don't pass your allele on. But if the polar bear found himself in Arctic, in the Yellowstone, he would die of heat stroke. So the situation is reversed. In a different environment, a different variation is favored, gets to pass on its alleles, etc. So Jacques Kolb, who was one of the co-discoverers of the operon, wrote a book called Chance and Necessity. He said that evolution is a two-step process. First, you have variation. That's chance. That's mutation. But which ones are passed on is not chance. That is dictated by necessity, by function and need. So that which works is passed on, that which works doesn't work is not. Now, next semester, we will meet many, many examples which indicate that, in fact, we are all related, all living things, and how some of this selection works. But we're going to stop here for now, except that we're going to give back the exam. So thank you all. Jesse are here with the exams, and they're going to bring them up. You can also get them from my office between 2 and 4 or after the evening class.